Blog Talk Radio.
All right, that was Hillary Clinton campaign theme song is a slam. It's like, Hillary, we love you because we're a corporation. that was pretty fun there. But today we're going to be talking about the election. And, I've had some friends who've kind of gone with that Never Trump movement, and I have nothing to do with it. More like a Never Think movement. Because honestly, you know, there is, you know, an actual reality and an actual country at stake. I understand I did the third party thing. I voted that way several times. But I don't think our country can take it. I don't think that our country can take another step to socialism. Lives are at stake. And you know I'm not lying because lives are being taken constantly right now. We have got to get this back together. You know, making jokes and stuff, but I mean, even in my town, over 90 murders have taken place this year alone in my town, okay? These policies that Barack Obama put in place are destroying the country. And basically, if it didn't change, our country would be doomed. So it's not just the fact that we need to not go a step worse. It's the fact that we need to step in the other direction. Let me get a few things together here. We try to get our guest back on the line. Let's play a little bit more of that for a second. Okay, hold on. Here we go. Here a second. Is our guest on with us? How are we doing? John Scott?
Good. How are you? It is me. How are you? Sorry I'm a couple of minutes late calling in.
No problem. Let's see here. Now, our mutual contact, he's a man of few words, so he gave me a few words for the topic. He said it's about the election. But tell us a little bit about yourself and what's going on.
Well, David set it up. Asked me if I wanted to come on and talk about talk with y'all about the presidential election, I guess, in particular. But I'm long-term political operative, I guess. I go back to the days of Bush 41 and John Chafee in Rhode Island for the U.S. Senate, and actually was the two-time nominee for U.S. Congress myself in Rhode Island against Patrick Kennedy of the infamous Kennedy clan, and then now has sort of backed out of politics, so I'm sort of just an interested spectator in this whole thing, and mostly do marketing and PR work and crisis communications and things that don't have a lot to do with politics these days, but I still keep interested.
That makes
in
you
it.
Happy.
Still keep. Exactly. Yeah, it's been, you know, politics got so full contact. I think it's funny how it's changed over the years from the early days, you know, going back my early days in it, back to the days of the 80s and Reagan and the Reagan Revolution to
like the 1800s was the wrestling contest, and then now it's into MMA, you know.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, although, you know, it's funny, you go back to politics in New York City in the 1800s, and they used to fight it out with knives and clubs and everything else. So I guess it's been worse at some time in our history.
Yeah, I know. I was really doing more comedy there. But basically, I guess one thing that Donald Trump has been pushing lately that I think we need to kind of, you know, ask ourselves, is the election rigged? Is there things that are swaying it unfairly in one direction?
You know, I think rigged is the wrong terminology. Are elections perfectly fair? No. I think there are certain things. But is it fair, is it unfair Republican side or Democrat side? No, it's not. That's not a partisan unfairness as much as it's an unfairness that sort of tilts to the power brokers in Washington. So it's the power of incumbency, and certainly incumbency, you know, gives people a little bit more of a media spotlight. But it also gives them a little bit more power. Literally, the system is set up such that those who get into power can stay in power. They can use all sorts of male privileges and everything else to influence. They can use behind the scenes with the media. They can use the power of floating stories and insider tips and this and that to influence media coverage of a race. So I don't necessarily see it as a you know, what Mr. Trump is saying one way or the other. There is certainly power in incumbency. And in this race, there is an incumbent quality to Secretary Clinton versus Mr. Trump, insider versus outsider. And I think that anything, you know, that tips on the balance scale tips towards the power of the insider. There's a reason that out of the top 12 richest counties in America, 8 of them surround the Beltway. That's not coincidence. So, you know, with money comes power, and with power comes money, and those two are symbiotic.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I've seen this. I've been an activist since about 2004. And, you know, if you get one of these guys who've been in office for, you know, let's say more than two terms, and a lot of times you'll see them there for 20, 30 years, it's impossible. I mean, not absolutely impossible, but, like, honestly, you know, you have, you know, somebody out there. I've had candidates. And these are just state elections, okay, not national ones. I've had candidates who, you know, pour their life savings and everything they have into upseating somebody who doesn't even campaign. You know, I mean, they just, you know, they're on the best door practically. These old guys are just sitting there and then just doing the yes men thing. And there's nothing they do. They don't really have to go door to door or anything. And, basically they just have it handed to them. And so, you know, I definitely see a lot of that going on. A lot of other things about, you know, the campaigns that are unfair. You know, dead voters, you know, who are these dead people who, you know, come back from the grave to keep on voting in the election?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. There aren't an overabundance of those cases, you know, proven. There's a lot of anecdotal stories, but I would tell you that when I was running in 2006, one of the first things we did was I had my campaign manager. We linked into Voter Vault, which then was the quintessential voter tracking program. It was the GOP. Karl Rove had sort of, you know, built it for 43's first race. And it had all kinds of information on voters all over the country and this and that. And so we pulled it. I pulled it just out of curiosity. I pulled it for my street. I had my campaign manager pull it for my own resident street. And sure enough, next door to me, I lived on the east side of Providence by Brown University, if any of your listeners are familiar with that, you know, old Ivy League school up there. And and it was hilarious because I looked, and living right next door to me was a guy who had voted in the last three elections, who was in his 70s, according to the voter vault. Since I had moved in 10 years, something like that, 8 years, it had been college students living in that house. There was no 70 some odd year old man living in that house, hadn't been there in years. Yet he had voted from that address. We never took the time to actually track him down and find out if he was a real person just voting at a different address, or whether he was voting at two addresses, or whether he was, you know, buried somewhere in Swan Point Cemetery. We never really answered that question, but there's an anecdotal sort of piece to it. You know, they haven't proven a lot of those cases, but there's one that just we came across literally in the opening days of my campaign.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, like, by the way, for the non-academic audience, you know, when you talk about anecdotes, it's something that kind of really makes a good point, and here's the reality, but if we're going with precision, it's not absolute proof. But basically, now, we haven't, you know, talked about this or anything before the program, so I don't know what your viewpoint is. But honestly, from my point of view, I feel like conservatives have let themselves become duped under a misconception. They keep on using the term the lesser of two evils of Trump and Hillary. And I think if you're talking about the category of their personal lives, then you're talking about the lesser of two evils. But when you're talking about what these candidates are actually planning to do, you know, to and for America, I think that, you know, you have a good plan, or at least a moderately good plan. I think it's a really good plan, but with a couple exceptions. And then you have, you know, what do you think as far as, like, are we dropping the ball, kind of like thinking about personality over thinking about the issues and the platform?
I do. I think politics has become about personality, and it's really ridiculous. We've gotten to, you know, look, sports marketing is king, and celebrity marketing and celebrity shows and reality TV and all of those things have sort of become the centerpiece and the mainstream of American culture in terms of media and, you know, things like that. And so there's this cult of personality. And in that, with that, you'd never get there aren't those questions about policy. And whether you like Mr. Trump or not, and I will tell you, I've done some radio shows, you know, as an analyst, political analyst, from the early days of this campaign. And I, from day one, was saying, there's no way Donald Trump makes it through this. There's no way. As soon as we turn to issues, he'll he'll lose his way, and the people will speak, and they'll listen to guys like Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or John Kasich or Chris Christie or anybody else that has a real command of the issues, and they'll realize that, you know, the emperor wears no clothes. And I was wrong at every turn. I was wrong at every single turn. And finally, Mr. Trump has sort of come out with some policy issues this weekend, though it speaks to a poorly run campaign that he drops that on a Saturday when, you know, you're in media dead time. He could have handed off a lot of his issues if they had dropped that a month ago on a Tuesday. But it really proves that there's this – you have two candidates who are among the most disliked people in their party, but they are both over and above everybody else in their party personalities, right? They're – love them or hate them, they're personalities. They're celebrities. They're celebrity politicians. He's a celebrity because he literally is a celebrity on Celebrity Apprentice, and she's a celebrity because she's the wife of a former president who was very popular in her party. That's all
well,
they really got going for them.
You raise a good point. When we look at Hillary Clinton, honestly, even though there was like all this antagonism, you know, Rush Limbaugh is as much to blame for her popularity as he is to be commended for ousting her and showing all the bad things she's done.
Oh, I would agree with that 100%. Absolutely right. Yeah, she is her popularity in some ways is absolutely a factor of conservative talk radio driving her as Satan. And when she becomes Satan sort of within the center right crowd, she becomes some sort of hero within the center left crowd and drives that name recognition, drives that name up, drives that celebrity up. And so that's where we end up with this. And it's if the Democrats had nominated anybody else and Mr. Trump had come out of the Republican side, the anybody else would be winning, you know, very handily, I would expect. If the Republicans had nominated anybody else against Secretary Clinton, they'd be crushing her. It wouldn't be close. I mean, Marco Rubio would be running away with this race right now. John Kasich would be running away with this race. Ted Cruz would be winning handily. So it's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah. My hope as far as getting Trump over is that I do feel that Trump has been very crafty about because, you see, he's a former Democrat, and he's really pulling on the strings a lot more than the media wants to let on. And if he wasn't pulling these strings, the media wouldn't be piling on. But basically, he's reaching hard for the black vote. I think at a minimum, I think he can get the black W. Bush vote. I think that he can get at least that. But the big vote that he's really searching for is the disenfranchised union workers, because the Clinton and the Democratic Party have worked them like slave masters. I mean, just over and over again, pushing that vote. And yet they have not produced the benefits, as we see with globalism and international trade and the illegal immigration and stuff. All that has really just ticked and kicked at, you know, the union status. And so I think that if he can pull that off and get the Republicans to reorganize behind him, and that's a hard part. I would offer this one solution, that is the fact that WikiLeaks did expose a lot of things, and that was including, you know, and this is like an old tactic, if you remember the old days of all these women before election, all of a sudden 9, 10 to a dozen women just automatically say, hey, I just remember he molested me. And they've, I saw them do that with, what was the 2012, the black Republican candidate in 2000, Herman Cain. I saw him doing it with Herman Cain. And so I kind of feel like that's what's going on there. But if we can get the Republicans back in the game, and he can still pull, and that's been one of the problems, he's trying to pull these disenfranchised Democrats in, I think we got a chance.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's funny. So part of the problem, there was a great article not too long ago in the New York Times, and it was the Sad Lonely Life of Donald Trump, I think it was called. And it was interesting. Whether you like the political bias or not, it doesn't matter. It was an and it wasn't a political bias necessarily. It was a look at Donald Trump. And one of the things that they said was that he doesn't have a lot of friends. He just doesn't have a lot of personal friends. And this is sort of an interesting reach out to him, to the public, and how does he adjust to getting that retail side of politics. But one of the things they mentioned is, because of the fact that he doesn't have a lot of personal friends, close personal friends, which happens with the ultra wealthy, I guess they sort of insulate themselves for whatever reason. He doesn't have a close inner circle of political advisors. And so if he had a close inner circle of political advisors, this race would be very interesting if they could make it about the central tenet that he has that makes him different from anyone else. If they could make this a referendum on insider versus outsider and nothing else, they would win in a landslide. Because right now people are sick and tired of being sick and tired. And you have the ultimate insider versus somebody who's out so outside that he doesn't even know how to maneuver the political system in terms of manipulate communications issues to schmooze people, to schmooze the general public from 30,000 feet. So if they could make that, if he had advisors that he listened to, and they could make this race a referendum on insider versus outsider, he would be golden. But he's left a more experienced political team.
I think that's one thing we did lose. I think that the early Trump movement got off foot because they saw him as the guy who's outside the system, and they were looking. I mean, about 2 or 3 years ago, they were looking for the Tea Party man, the statesman, the candidate who has not, been a elected official or anything like that. And so, I think that that was something in play at the beginning of the GOP. And then, somewhere they kind of lost their way in pushing that message. And people are like, well, he's a part of the system because he's rich. And his whole speech at the beginning was, everyone is compromised. Everyone out here is compromised by money. I have too much money to be bought off. I may control the system, but I'm not, slave to the system. And I'm saying this is corrupt and I'm here to change it. So, I think there is a little bit of that, that original Teflon that they need to spray back onto the pan, because he's just like nothing could faze him. And basically, I think it's just the fact that, just some people, saying, okay, I think it was just basically the turmoil he had with the Republicans in the middle of or maybe early October or so. I think it was that where he thought, okay, I've got everybody on with me, and now we're going to ride on into victory, and all of a sudden things shifted. But as I said, I think you've got to tell the general Republican audience, say, look, they didn't really get me. It's like they pulled out something, and everybody's got something in the past. I mean, even, George W. Bush, looks probably more saintly than any other president, with the exception of Ronald Reagan for different reasons. But, basically he had like a past with drugs and stuff like that, but you have to, and as a party, we have to be more protective of our candidates sometimes. Democrat Party, it's like it doesn't matter how many people you murder or rape or whatever, you're the fair-haired, idol,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that goes back. It's funny. I mentioned earlier, some of that goes back to the Tammany Hall days in New York City, and the whole insider boss Tweed kind of thing. There's a whole historical precedent of that in the Democratic Party. And they're just really good at that. And you see you see what happens. This year was a great example. Come back to sort of merging your last two thoughts into one. So you insider candidate come out of the Republican Party. You would have had an outsider candidate in Bernie Sanders come out of the Democrat Party if the game had been played fairly, according to the WikiLeaks, if we believe the WikiLeaks, which I believe those as being legitimate emails. So if you believe that, and you look at what Debbie Wasserman Schultz was doing, the deck was loaded. What's that?
One thing that people forget about WikiLeaks is that WikiLeaks is a far leftist organization. You know, they go outside the wall and they're outside the country, but they're a far leftist organization, not a far right wing organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, I mean, there's a case to be made, I guess, that WikiLeaks whole thing that pushing a Trump presidency destabilizes our election system and destabilizes our system in general, and that helps Russia. And I mean, if you got into the whole international sort of, but I've never necessarily seen Julian Assange as being a puppet of the Russian government either. I don't think he's a puppet of totalitarian government.
Hey, you know, they kept on making those connections, but I was like, are those connections really there? You know,
interesting. They, you know, they say that it's been proven by 17 of the intelligence services in the United States. But basically, what it was the FBI said that was the case, and then so one of the organizations that supposedly proved that it had Russian ties was Coast Guard Intelligence Service. I can guarantee the folks at the Coast Guard Intelligence Service didn't do a full investigation into the WikiLeaks Russian connection. They just went along with, yeah, the FBI said it's true. So what you see is the FBI sort of certifies it one way and everybody else goes along with that. And now, you know, this is the same FBI that basically said, well, you know, yeah, Secretary Clinton and this and that. And yeah, if she was somebody else, maybe we'd prosecute her, but we don't have the evidence to do it. You know, and it's the same place where you had the justice, you had the head of the Justice Department meeting with former President Clinton on a plane for 15 minutes, 2 days before that decision. So there's always those entangling sort of alliances and clouds hanging around everything. And just because somebody says something's true, you can't take it to be true at all, one way or the other.
And, you know, that's one of the things when you talk about intelligence, you're talking about, you know, probably, you know, half of the intelligence community is a double agent. You know, I mean, everybody's working with 25 different hats. And so, yeah, everybody's connected, so this person's connected. But, you know, whether there's a real motivation and a real, like, okay, Russia told me to do this. No, it's just the guy had, you know, went to coffee, you know, had some coffee with a Russian guy, and, you know, they chatted just as much as he did with the Chinese or the, you know, British or whatever. But,
and there's so much to be gained in the intelligence game by floating bad information out there. And so, you know, you can create entire groupthink processes in the United States or in Russia or anywhere else by sort of floating something that's not true and getting people to link onto it and believe in it. So you never can really tell what those things are that come out. You know, misdirection plays are pretty common, and as common as they are on the football field, they are in the intelligence community. So it's,
well, and it goes back to like keeping our eye on the ball. 'Cause you know, I was watching the third debate and Chris Wallace goes out there and he says, you know, Trump, you know, you're saying that you might have a problem with the election and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, he's like, yeah, well, I'll have to wait and see. And, you know, he's like, well, that's never been done in American history. And I'm sitting there at my TV and I'm like, Al Gore. I mean, it took to say, you know, hold on, you said this has never been done. What kind of, you know, it was just like the dumbest thing, because it was like, you know, that was our guy. That was the guy who was going to, like, you know, balance off all the hyper-liberalism, and then he comes out with a gaffe like that, and I was just like, You know, and just because I'll say, I was like, say Al Gore.
Yeah, it's yeah. People forget, I guess. I mean, it's, you know, it wasn't that long ago, right? It was this big giant issue when it happened. But yeah, you're spot on. It, the Gore election. It's funny. I was talking about that with somebody the other day, and sort of went through the process. I had even forgotten sort of the details of that and the meaningfulness of the hanging chads and how that the hanging chads sort of fit into the SCOTUS case, and had to go back and figure out why it was Bush v. Gore was the case. And it was, you know, ultimately because Gore brought the challenge to the Florida elections, and it was upheld. So it was Bush v. Gore, with Gore being the winner of that case. It was this interesting, even though Bush never, he had a lead in all the recounts. He had a lead in that. There was no question as to whether he ended up winning by 543 votes in that Florida election with the count the way it was. But, you know, it was about deadlines and everything else. Yeah, it's happened. It happened big, and it happened, or as Mr. Trump would say, it happened bigly. It's happened before. So it's, yeah, you're spot on. They missed that.
There's almost like a scale of anything that you find the media slamming at Trump, you can find it magnified in Hillary. And, she's sitting there talking about ties with Russia, and I'm thinking, China? I remember Sandy Berger? You know, all sorts of, like, you know, crooked deals and stuff behind the scenes, the Clinton Foundation and all that kind of stuff. And, I mean, just everything. I mean, it's like, even let's say, like, you know, well, Trump's an adulterer, okay? Well, you know what? I'm going to take the elephant out of the room, okay? Let's get rid of Slick Willie. Let's focus on, you know, what was that one fella who was rumored to have had an affair with Hillary in the 90s, Vince Foster, and then he ends up
Vince Foster.
Dead. Yeah, they claim it was a suicide, but it looked like shooting behind his head, so it's probably a murder.
Yeah, I mean, that's a story. That's a long, long ago story that's sort of gone away, but it's something that keeps coming up every once in a while. And you're absolutely right. I will say, go back for a second, that I thought that Chris Wallace did a much better job and much more fair job than certainly the previous moderators had done. I thought Mark Raddatz was off.
I don't want to be fair either, because he did a great job, you know, trying to keep things balanced. A couple times I do think, like, he was searching a little bit compared to, for our side, I think he could have toned it back a little bit. But then again, compared to what was going on with the leftist propaganda that was going on, it was like not even, like, you know, anything close to, like, a legitimate regulated debate was going on. And, yeah, he did a great job altogether of just keeping things, you know, fair and balanced and stuff, and just asking simple questions and not sitting there. I mean, you know, yeah, he'd have to, like, you know, keep people calm down and everything like that. But honestly, you know, there was an intentional side with the media leftist debaters or moderators. Well, we'll say debaters, when they would try to stop specific answers by Trump and Pence. You know, there's specific try to stop them just so they didn't get that point across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Martha Raddatz thing was she inserted herself as a third candidate. I kept wishing if they were going to have a third candidate, they would have let Gary Johnson in instead of Martha Raddatz. You know, but she inserted herself as a third debater in that second debate. And Chris Wallace did a good job. He whacked her on Clinton Foundation issues. He whacked her on some of the WikiLeaks email stuff. He called her out when she answered some things a little bit less than truthfully. That was basically it forced her to pivot. I was talking to somebody this morning about the fact that, you know, Mr. Trump got, you know, a lot of liar, liar, pants on fire ratings and all the you know, fact checkers. And she only got a couple. And the reason she only got a couple is because she didn't really answer the questions that Wallace was throwing at her. And Saturday Night Live even did a great job of making fun of it, where they're going, Carol? Oh, is that my friend calling me? And that's how you pivot. You know, there she just would go on to a whole different question, and she'd veer off the question. And so she sort of figured out that she's not going to lie because she's just not going to even answer questions. And, you know, she even said that.
You just got to look at, like, I sat there and watched in that debate. I think it was the second debate. Anderson Cooper looks over at Hillary Clinton and says, Hillary, does Trump have what it takes to lead the country?
Mm-hmm.
And if that,
yeah.
I mean, like, you know, why don't you say, like, you know, tell us, are you going to vote for him or yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that second debate was supposed to be an open forum, a town hall, if you will, and it ended up being a lot more questions from the moderators. Though I will say that Anderson Cooper was much less self-insertive than Raddatz was. But you know, this time Wallace, to his credit, they're on the debate commission's website all along from the beginning. There's been an opportunity to ask questions, to submit possible questions for the debates. And they had those, and they did not use them in the second one. They just didn't use them. Chris Wallace went right to one of the top five questions on gun control, was one of his first questions. And so the because he went with those questions that had been suggested, it was much more issue driven. Whereas, because there was a sort of an agenda with the town hall debate, particularly out of Arthur Raddatz, it was all the first half hour, literally the first half hour was about a tape discussion between Donald Trump and Billy Bush that happened 10 years ago, the first half hour. So a third of the debate was dedicated to something, a private discussion that happened 10 years ago. And is that germane to the whole thing? Yes. We want to know about our candidates. We want to know about their personal, but is it 33% of it? It goes back to your early question about personality over policy. And do people really care about policy anymore? And the fact of the matter is that the majority of people do.
We know it's, you know, like the left manufactured the whole thing. I mean, like, number one, you know, in a lot of our conservative friends, you know, the issue of, like, privacy has come up in conservative circles over the last couple of years. And you have to stop yourself and think, Trump was a private citizen. He was not aware that he was being recorded. And then this is something that automatically the media has the right to just get into your private life, throw it out there, put it out of context, you know. And a lot of that discussion, and when I was, like, sitting there just about wanting to puke for 2 or 3 days, afraid to even, like, watch the video. But when I watched the video, all of a sudden, there's a whole lot of stuff that makes it more normalized. And, you know, at the end of the video, it's got Trump with, like, Billy Bush and a model, and Billy Bush wants to run off. And then all of a sudden you could see that Trump was getting worried about being seen alone with the model. And why mm-hmm. would this, you know, supposed, you know, rapist and all this kind of stuff, you know, super adulterer and everything, why would he feel uncomfortable that he's alone with a model? Well, it's because he was actually married and he actually did care about that. You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, all these things taken so far out of context, and the media totally gets a pass on it. You know, it's like, you know, how dare you have spread this out? He spread it out to one person and you spread it out to, you know, 100 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, and I know that, like, you know, we do have to deal with personal life issues and stuff like that, but there is something where, you know, one of our big problems is we're giving the media unlimited access when it comes to spying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's people. The biggest key to political change or political, you know, to sort of a rebalancing of the political process, I think, is media IQ, right? And people have to have some sort of media savvy, some sort of, you know, put some sort of guard up and skepticism of the media. The more skeptical we are of some of that, and the more questions we personally ask, and the more questions we personally ask about the stories that come to us, the better off we're going to be. The one thing that's sort of driving media now, the reason print media is dying. Print media, you used to know there was a Republican newspaper and a Democrat newspaper. You used to know that in the cities, and they proudly, and this comes out of New York too. A lot of our political process comes out of the you know, the old New York ward system. But you literally saw media pop up around City Hall. New York City Hall was the first big city hall that was built, and the media buildings literally popped up around there. And so media and politics have been tied together for a long time. Just used to be that you knew what the Republican paper was and what the Democrat paper was. You knew what the fair paper was and what the muckraking paper was. So you had, now we've got the death of that. And what's taking its place, I subscribe to the quickest news I get is Russia Today, the Russian news service that I get on an app on my phone. And they beat everybody to every story. Yes, they're biased against America in a lot of ways. Yes, they're biased to Russia. But what's happening in small town America pops on Russia Today long before it pops anywhere else on my local news station or on CNN or anything else. Why? Because they are linked directly into Twitter. And so we've gone from those newspapers where we knew the bias that were literally right next to City Hall in New York to the reporter is you and me on the street with a cell phone and a camera and a Twitter account. And so Russia Today links directly into that. And so the upside to that is we get our news quicker and we get political issues and political events and those things quicker. The bad news there is that everybody's looking to be, you know, break the big story. Everybody thinks they're Mr. Reporter. And everybody has a bias. You know, everybody that's doing that reporting, that Twitter, that personal reporting, has a bias. They're political animals. We are political animals as human beings. So it's kind of changed the face of everything.
Well, let me go back on one thing that I do want us to kind of emphasize, and that is the issues at hand. And I was amazed at how open Hillary was in that third debate, speaking about her love of, you know, high taxes, you know, that the evil was Reaganomics all of a sudden. And, you know, basically, now some things are good because I think for Republicans, listen to Hillary Clinton and she'll tell you, hey, Trump's pro-life, that's evil. Trump wants to cut your taxes. That's so evil, you know. And then she was just open and honest about how, you know, she was had a specific leftist bent when it came to Supreme Court justices. That it was all about pushing a social agenda. I mean, with no apology, she wants to protect abortion. She wants to push gay rights without even considering a judge being unbiased or anything. And I'll admit that, like, you know, Trump, I think, just because he has been many years a Democrat, it's hard for him to use a conservative brain. I mean, he's pushing some conservative issues, but it's hard for him to articulate it the way conservatives usually want to do it. And basically, I disagree with him saying, like, you know, I'm going to get the pro-life judge. And it's like, well, I do like the judge to be pro-life, but really you just got to say I'm going to be a constructionist because – pro-life is constitutional. I mean, you know, if you don't have liberty in the pursuit of happiness, you don't have any of the other rights either. You know? So
right.
That's where it could have gone. But what did you think about those when it came to the open issues and how are conservatives receiving that?
Yeah, I think part of the issue is that there's a way to send a conservative message and say it in a moderate manner. And what you have with Mr. Trump sometimes is that he's actually got a moderate message that he says in a very caustic manner. And so that sort of, that